When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Aaron, back with another one of our interviews with Polk Award winners. Today, I'm talking to Brian Howie. He was a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley's journalism program when he produced this story in partnership with the LA Times and also a podcast version in partnership with Reveal. It's a great conversation about how he came to find out about this controversial policing technique and turn it into both a text and audio story. I hope you enjoy it. We'll be back with more Polk Award winners later this week. Welcome to the Long Form Podcast, Brian Howie.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on your Polk Award.
Thank you.
I would love to talk about the story that you won the Polk Award for, which was both a Los Angeles Times story and a Reveal story. Did they both win the Polk, or did one or the other one of them win the Polk?
They both won the Polk as a package.
Okay. Yes. Excellent. Then I will have no obligation to speak about one more so than the other. For people who haven't read it, just give me the sort of brief like elevator pitch of what the story is.
Sure. So essentially, this is a story about a police tactic that I learned is very popular in California. Essentially, after someone dies in an interaction with police, investigators will go to the families of that person and begin to question them without first telling them what's happened. And they question the families about their relatives' drug use, their mental health, whether they were a deadbeat parent, their propensity for violence, their housing status, marital strife, et cetera, et cetera. And only after investigators have gotten that information do they then reveal to the family that their relative is dead or badly injured and in the hospital. And like I said, I found that this was common in California. We found 20 instances of this tactic being used across the state. And we found that the information that families were giving investigators was actually being used against them if they later sued the department for the wrongful death of their relatives. We also found that one of the largest private companies in the policing industry, Lexapol, had actually popularized this tactic through one of its public online training webinars.
So I think one of the interesting things about this story is that you kind of start with the like, where does the theory come from, and then trace it to its real world application. Was that also the trajectory of your own research into this stuff, that you started out sort of understanding the story from the training manual level?
Yeah. I mean, actually, the way I got turned on to this story is I was staring at a Lexapol policy manual, and I had not really heard of Lexapol at that point. I was looking at every page of this manual, and I saw this little copyright symbol in the word Lexapol next to it on every page. And So I spent some time on Google reading everything that I could about this company and found out that it had come under fire through investigative reporting and academics like Joanna Schwartz and Ingrid Eagley at the UCLA Law School for writing vaguely worded policy manuals that were so vaguely worded, it was tough to tell whether or not an officer had violated one of their policies. And that was actually exactly the situation I was in. Looking at the drone policy for the Vallejo Police Department, I was struggling to determine whether or not officers were violating their own policies. And so from there, I started digging into Lexapol as a company because it felt like there was more to it than just vaguely worded policy manuals. And I spent weeks going through all of their online materials, namely their webinars, and found that there were a lot of interesting things happening in these webinars. Lexapol co-founder Bruce Prayett had hosted quite a few of them in the early days of Lexapol's free webinar trainings that they posted online. And his advice seemed to center around something that Joanna Schwartz and Ingrid Eagley at UCLA had brought up before, that really the focus of this training was around mitigating civil liability, helping police departments avoid getting sued, or helping them prevail when they did get sued. And so from that came this advice from Bruce Prayett that was kind of shocking to me. One of them was, if you seriously injure someone while you're arresting them, make sure you clean the blood off of them before you take the evidence photo of their injuries. Get them smiling for the camera so as to undermine any claims they might have of serious injury if they later sue the department. You know, another one was, if you encounter someone who appears to be in the midst of a mental health crisis, call it into dispatch as a drug case. Because if that person gets injured in this arrest and they later sue you, it's going to show in front of the jury that you thought this guy was on drugs. And jurors don't like, quote unquote, druggies, is the way that Bruce Prayett put it. So it was all very much centered around helping police departments avoid civil liability. But the one piece of advice that really stuck out was his advice to approach the families of people who have been killed or seriously injured in a police incident before they know what's happened, right? The way he puts it is, you know, the grapevine has gotten lightning speed in the age of social media. I want you sending someone over there as soon as you can before the dust settles to get to the family and find out what this suspect's been up to. And he sort of plays a dual part in this webinar of the hypothetical detective and the hypothetical mother of the person who's just been killed by police, right? The detective shows up. He doesn't tell her what's been going on. He just says, oh, you know, I want to find out a little bit more about your son. We've had an interaction with him. What's he been up to? And this hypothetical mother then goes on and on and on about how her son has been on drugs and he has mental health issues and anger issues. And, you know, he's been kicking his dog or tearing stuff off the walls. And then after she's revealed all of this about her troubled relationship with her son, Prayett instructs the officers, you know, that's when you get a more concerned look on your face and a somber tone, right? And you say, well, I'm so sorry, Mrs. Jones, but your son was involved in a shootout with the officers and he didn't survive. And I think the most important part of this is that then Bruce Prayett switches back to the role of the mother and she says, wait, what? My son, the Eagle Scout? No. And that really points at where Prayett's getting at with this tactic, right? He's saying here that parents with the knowledge that their child has been killed by the police will suddenly frame them in this completely unrealistic light, that they were some perfect angel baby that had never gotten in trouble in their lives or something in order to help their case. Because, of course, the parents are automatically thinking about suing the police as soon as they find out that their child has died.
So you can just watch these like webinars online. You didn't even need like a subscription or anything to access the material.
Right. I mean, yes, all of these videos that I'm just described to you were available online for the public to see. They had been live. Officers had watched them in the moment, but they were available for anyone to see. They also sold more online content to subscribers.
And so sort of from this starting point where you've seen the training materials and you're aware that a lot of these California police departments have ongoing contracts for these kind of trainings. What did you sort of feel like you needed to get to turn this into a story? Like, what was the, I must have it in order to feel like I can feel good about this story? And I guess also in a larger sense, like as someone working within a journalism school, like what is the process by which you like are like, I'm going to turn this into not just like a student story, but a story that's published, you know, by an outside organization?
Sure. Yeah. So at that time, I had started with the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley, which is sort of this hybrid collection of professional journalists and student journalists working together to produce top-notch investigative reporting that then gets published out into the real world. You know, we're not just working to learn how to be investigative reporters, we're producing stories that get published in actual publications. And so at the time, I was working with a couple of editors at the IRP. One of them was David Barstow, the other was Wesley Lowery, and the other was Christine Schiavo. And, you know, after I had found these webinars, I brought them to these folks and said, you know, I think that there's a story here. I don't think any publication has ever really focused on this specific piece of advice. And we were actually thinking about just doing a story about Bruce Praet's advice because it was shocking in and of itself. But I think the conversation eventually turned, thanks to Wesley Lowery, to, well, wait a second, you know, this advice is controversial. It's crazy, sure, but is this happening in the real world? That was the question. Because it's one thing for some guy in a webinar to say, you know, go out and do this in your day-to-day job. It's another
People
thing.
Say a lot of things in webinars.
People do say a lot of things in webinars, exactly. But whether or not people are actually going out and doing those things is another question entirely.
Right, right.
And so the question became, you know, with Lexapol, which, by the way, you know, provides policy manuals and training for something like 95% of police departments in California, and something like a fifth of the police agencies in the country at last count. This is an extremely influential company. So the question is, you know, did anyone actually take this seriously? Was anyone actually doing this? And so from there began the very long and tedious process of trying to figure out whether or not this was happening in the real world.
And one, what did you find? And two, how did you go about adapting the evidence that this is happening in the real world, like into an audio format? How did you figure out like how you're going to sort of tell these moments as story?
The way that we did it was a sort of multi-step process. I think at first it was trying to figure out whether or not this is actually a real thing. So yep. I started calling civil rights attorneys who specialize in police misconduct cases in California. And in a couple cases, actually got laughed at when I asked, is this a thing? Have you ever seen this before? Because they were telling me, I've seen this so much, I don't even see it as like an odd or strange thing. It's just part and parcel with a police shooting investigation. That's just how it works. But then I started calling attorneys that specialize in the same thing outside of California and got a very different reaction from most of them, who were horrified to learn that this was happening, had never seen this before, or in the cases where they said they had, it ended up not being quite the same thing. And so focused largely on California. And from there, I started thinking about the different ways that we could actually prove that this was happening, right? And what I learned from talking to these civil rights attorneys is that in a lot of cases, these interviews where the investigators are approaching the families of the person who's been killed are recorded and transcribed and used as evidence in civil rights cases sometimes. At the very least, they're included in the police report or the incident reports. And luckily, a couple of years before I started reporting on this, a law had been passed, SB 1421, which in California makes records related to the investigations of police killings public by law. It's a very useful law for criminal justice reporters, and I took full advantage of it and was able, with that law, to get actual recordings of these death notification interviews and get transcriptions of them. And in cases where those two things didn't exist, I was able to get police incident reports where the detectives who questioned the families detailed the order in which they approached them, what questions they asked them, et cetera, et cetera. And so through those records, was able to piece together in how many of these cases this interview tactic was used among the ones that were brought to my attention by civil rights attorneys or families who belonged to these like Facebook groups of people who'd lost loved ones to police. The second part of your question is about how it became an audio piece. And I think it became clear pretty early on when we started getting these recordings of families being interviewed, just how much more emotionally impactful this story could be as an audio piece than as a print piece. Because it's one thing to hear about this tactic and hear about, you know, parents being questioned in this way. It's another thing entirely to hear the change in a parent's voice when they realize, you know, for the past 20 minutes, they've been speaking ill of a relative who's actually been dead the entire time. And to hear that wave of grief and sometimes that feeling of betrayal that cropped up in their voice and how they, the way that they spoke to the officers afterwards changed, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it was, I thought it was a really powerful aspect of this, and I just didn't think that a print piece would capture it. And so we took it to Reveal after we published the Los Angeles Times piece and said, hey, look, we think this would make a great audio piece. And luckily they agreed.
Yeah, I think that one of the dimensions of the piece that's sort of unexpected is the degree to which the sort of, I regret telling the officers these things becomes sort of like a second victimization and almost like a secondary crime, and sort of the consistency of that reaction amongst, you know, disparate people who'd encountered it. It's sort of one of the dimensions to which the story goes beyond being sort of just a policy piece to a story about these people's lives. What are the like contours for you when you have audio like that of like, what are your sort of obligations to getting consent from people to putting it in there? And also just sort of like navigating, you know, this sort of larger experience they've had and the role it plays in this story that you have that's actually mostly about this guy's like weird, like training webinars.
I mean, I think in terms of the obligation to the families, we got consent from all family members whose stories were told in either versions of this investigation. But in particular, the Reveal piece, you know, we made sure to convey to families, hey, we would like to use the audio of this specific moment. And yeah, we understand that that might be really traumatic for you. We want to make sure it's okay before we publish this, even though, you know, like legally we have the, we right, have the right to publish it if we wanted to, because it's a public record. It just seemed like we would probably just be doing the exact same thing that this tactic did if we went and ran that on air without actually speaking to the families about it first.
How did you find a balance between all of these threads, like the stories of the families, the sort of firsthand experience, the webinar lexapol level, and then the sort of police training and like police's firsthand experiences? How did you think about like what you wanted to get from each of these things and structuring them into a larger story?
I mean, I think at its core, this is a story about policing culture, right? And so I think that that was the center point that we worked around with this story. It was looking at how this culture of self-preservation that was being advertised by Lexapol, by Bruce Prayett, who was a former officer himself and sort of considered like an old guard police officer in contrast to some of the newer age police officers who are starting to acknowledge that, okay, we need to start listening to the communities that we're serving and listening to those complaints. And instead of being defensive when we get criticism, actually accepting that and thinking about changing how we do things. And so, you know, I think the way that I approached this was to both get the stories from these families who justifiably felt double betrayed by this. You know, not only was their family member killed by the segments of government who ostensibly are here to protect and serve, but they also were sort of deceived into giving up information about their family member. But also, I wanted to get the side of policing experts, people who had been in this profession, to figure out whether or not there was actually a real justifiable reason for doing this. And that was actually, that was one of the more surprising aspects of this reporting for me, is that while I did have a few people who defended it, by and large, the law enforcement officers I spoke to about this tactic were actually horrified to hear of it. There were a few who made the argument that, you know, listen, we have to do some things that are kind of sticky and icky when we are investigating these things. And that includes maybe getting information from people without giving them all of the facts. And that's just part of how we get the information. But most of the policing experts that I talked to said, well, you can get that information from the family afterwards. You can get most of the information that's pertinent from public records or from records that you have privilege to access as an investigator without speaking to the family at all. Of course, you want to speak to the family, but, you know, in some cases, police experts said the families, you know, shouldn't be getting this death notification from an investigator at all. They should be getting it from someone else. When they get the death notification, they need time to process that before they're doing any interviews. And so I actually found that while I was expecting to have to do more of a both sides story, where we explain why law enforcement officers would want to do this tactic, by and large, the majority of them said you shouldn't have to. And so that was very surprising to me.
For people who are listening, I mean, there's a pretty important moment in the story in which you confront Bruce Prayett, the guy who's famous from the webinar, Bruce Prayett, and you talk to him in a parking lot. And you're talking to him in a parking lot because he has, you know, refused various other requests to talk to him. But it's like a pretty high stakes moment that I feel like could have gone a number of different ways and ends up going, I feel like, a pretty compelling way. But I'm curious, like, how you prepared for that. What were the possibilities you thought of how that could have gone, and, you know, what you would have done if you hadn't, say, been able to get that piece of the story?
Yeah, I mean, to answer the last part of that question first, if we hadn't gotten that piece of the story, I don't think it would have been nearly as good of a story, because it's so important to get every side of an investigation that you can, to give everyone an opportunity to speak. And to I mean, I think one of our greatest fears as investigative reporters is to get something wrong because we didn't talk to the right person, we missed some piece of context that completely changes the story, which happens in your reporting, right? And so we wanted to make sure that Bruce Prayett had a chance to give us that information if it existed. The way that I prepared for that interview was actually this long, drawn-out process of trying to track down Bruce Prayett, because I had called his office, I had sent him emails trying to get in touch with him, and hadn't been able to get a hold of him. I'd asked for Lexapol to make him available. They had declined to do that. And so I had resorted to just doing creative Googling, trying to find where Bruce Prayett might give his next training, because I knew that he gave in-person trainings all over California. He was quite well known for training officers across the state. And so after a while, I ended up finding a training in Southern California and booked a trip to go down there. And it was like a few days after I graduated from journalism school, and I got COVID.
No.
I couldn't go. And it was the only time that I knew that he was giving a training at any time in the future. And my contract with the investigative reporting program was up in August. So I had just a few months to find this guy and interview him. But in my fugue state of COVID brain, was doing more and more Googling, and eventually found another training that he was giving out just outside of Fresno. And it was open to the public, supposedly, and I signed up. And the organizer called me and eventually found out that I was a reporter and said, nope, you can't come. And so I was like, crap, I don't really know what to do. But I talked to my editor about it, and we decided, you know what, like, you might be able to stand outside of a wall and hear something or get something. You can chase him around a parking lot or something. Who knows? So I drove out there. Before I did, me and my editor sat down and wrote down a list of questions. You know, If you get one question with this guy, what's it going to be? If you get 5 minutes with him, what are your, you know, five questions going to be? If he gives you 15, what are those questions going to be? And sort of bracketed those out and wrote them all down and went over them over and over and over again before I drove out there. And again, before I walked up to this training. And he was, you know, he was giving this training at a, I think it was in a city council chamber or something. And I walked up outside and waited for him to come out and shoved a microphone in his face and started asking him questions. And at first he didn't want to talk. He declined an interview. As you can hear in the story, you know, he turned me down and he started walking away. And, you know, for a second there, I thought, well, that's it. You know, I gave it the good old college try. You know, I gave him an opportunity and I was getting ready to turn around and walk away. But then, you know, I remembered all of these families that I've been interviewing for all of these months who'd been telling me about how the worst moment of their lives, the moment they found out that their son or their daughter had been killed, was also this moment of betrayal, this realization that they'd been tricked into giving up dirt on their loved one who was dead. And I thought that they probably wouldn't be very happy with me if I just let Bruce Prayett walk away with a no thank you. So I chased after him and I kept asking him questions. And to my surprise, he started answering them. And I was very lucky in that Bruce was not able to find his rental car in the parking lot. And so we paced around that parking lot for something like 15 minutes while he looked for his car. He would start walking away from me. I'd ask him a question. He'd get frustrated. He'd spin around and he'd, you know, get after me and sort of chide me for some what he thought were kind of silly questions. And we just went back and forth and like that for something like 15 minutes until it became clear at that point that there really wasn't much else to say. And he walked off and found his car.
It's a funny story. What have you been doing since then? So you're now you've graduated from journalism school. What projects have you occupied yourself with?
Yeah. So actually, I'm glad you called me today, because as of today, I can officially announce that I'm a local investigations fellow with the New York Times and Mississippi Today. I'm actually calling you from Mississippi. I've been out here for the past 8 months now. My colleagues and I, Jerry Mitchell, Nate Rosenfield, and Alyssa Daly, have been investigating the power of Mississippi sheriff's departments. And my colleague Nate Rosenfield and I published an investigation in November about the Rankin County Sheriff's Department and the quote-unquote goon squad. The goon squad's a group of deputies who have been going around torturing drug suspects during arrests. And everything from waterboarding to holding blowtorches to feet to strangling with lamp cords, people they suspect of using or dealing drugs, allegedly.
So you're now covering this issue kind of in a broader sense across Mississippi?
That's right. We've got a few irons in the fire. You know, I can't give away too much, but we've got a few things we're working on both in Rankin County and more broadly.
Well, thank you very much for this interview, Brian.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Aaron. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks to Gabriella Saldivia for editing this episode. Thanks to everyone over at the George Polk Awards. We will be having more Polk Awards episodes coming later this week. And of course, thanks to everyone over at Vox.